This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald. Here's a segment from our show, Kelly and Company, that airs weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio.
Isn't it convenient that we have a round table?
Well, it's actually oval. Just saying.
Yeah, a blind guy feels it now, goes, well, I don't know. I guess it is oval.
Kind of oval.
Good heavens. He brought in a pile of things to talk about today. Was suggesting to Rumya during the break, folks, that maybe I'll just forward this script to her because, you know, I'm having those challenges getting my mouth to cooperate today. So what better thing to do than let the Amuthan have it? Okay.
Yeah, but it can't be on this kind of need to pass it on basis, you know? It's got to be all the time or never.
Normally, she's annoyed because she has no concept of what are the questions. Here I'm offering to give her everything in topics.
I've grown up now. I've come to the acceptance.
I can't be bothered, in other words. That's what it means. Oh, my heavens, folks. What we do on the roundtable, it's an open conversation on a variety of topics, handpicked by yours truly. Today's guest joining us is AMI audio producer from Now with Dave Brown, Mr. Paul Daniel. Hello, sir.
Hey, Kelly. Hey, Rumya.
Hey, Paul.
We're going to try to make Paul feel very welcome with this first item, right? Okay. I don't know if you know how much of a fan this man is of the Beatles. Paul McCartney says he did not break up the Beatles. Have a listen.
Paul McCartney tells BBC Radio 4 it was John Lennon who ended the Beatles, or as he calls him, our Johnny. McCartney has often been blamed for the breakup. McCartney says part of the confusion comes from their manager, who wanted them to keep quiet so he could finish several business deals. McCartney says Lennon walked into a room one day and said, "I am leaving the Beatles." McCartney adds, is that instigating the split or not? He says he was sad about the breakup because they were still making pretty good stuff. I'm Archie Zaralletta.
Well, it sounds like what Paul George Martin would have been that. Let's just keep this quiet for a little bit. Is that right? Now, what do you think, Paul? Would you say this is accurate?
Kelly, first of all, I want to thank you for giving me this gift on a Thursday afternoon in October 2021. Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
Well, it's enough time for Paul to come clean, right?
Okay. But no, I've read enough about these kind of things. And from the timeline, for years, McCartney was always blamed. But the reality was it was not necessarily – it wasn't that the timeline was wrong. Sometime in early 69, September 69, Lennon turns to the three of them and says, I'm out of here. I want out. And he was told by the business manager, a guy named Alan Klein, who three of them had signed to contract. Paul never agreed to have Alan Klein as a manager, which caused a lot of friction in the band. And he convinced them, keep quiet, don't tell anybody about this, because they were renewing their contracts with Capitol Records and EMI Records for 7 more years, so get a better royalty rate. So what happened was, it was kept quiet.
Right.
But the thing is, McCartney did, and so people got the impression that Paul broke up with the Beatles because in April 1970, he sent out a press release saying, I'm quit the Beatles, with a press release saying, why is he leaving? So people got the impression that Paul announced it first.
Right.
But Lennon announced quietly to the rest of them that he wanted out first.
And then along comes Paul with Wings, so on and so on.
Yeah, he made it public first, but Lennon messed it private to them, yeah.
Yeah, well, and again, I mean, I had heard this years ago, too, that was the thinking that it was John in the sense of that he wanted to do other things, and Yoko and him had other plans and things to do. So that's what you always heard. But isn't it funny, Rumya, this is going back 40, what are we, Paul? 51 years ago. Sorry, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do the math, Kelly. Come on.
Come on, Kelly. Come on.
And it's time. Come on. It's time to be able to speak freely. When is that point where you could say, you know, I'm not speaking ill of the dead in reference to John Lennon, but for Paul to finally say, look, I've had enough of this. It wasn't me. You know, Rumya, there's that sort of timeline.
Yeah, there is the timeline, and I'm just saying, like, it's okay. You can tell us that you didn't want to lose the money, and that's why you didn't want to tell us the truth. But yeah, totally. There's all these. It's kind of interesting that there's still the conspiracies, and there's still, like Paul McCartney and people coming out and saying, well, to be honest, it wasn't that.
This isn't quite the way it happened. I'm so fed up now. I will say it, and you know, because there's only so much of that. announcing and saying you're going to do because you don't want to look like that kind of sour grapes kind of person. How dare you speak like that? And I'm going to stick, unfortunately, on a little bit more of a sour note. France is launching a campaign to abolish the death penalty around the world.
French President Emmanuel Macron announcing France will launch a campaign for the worldwide abolition of the death penalty as part of its upcoming presidency of the European Union. A conference will be held in Paris to discuss the matter, and France will also work with other member states on a UN resolution requiring countries to report the number of executions carried out each year. The announcement came on the day France marked 40 years since it got rid of the death penalty. Inés de l'Equaterra, ABC News, Paris.
Rami, I don't know how truthful countries would be in announcing. I mean, we understand here in Canada, it's blanket. We don't do that. Other countries are kind of like, well, it depends. They'll get the death penalty if this, that, or the other thing. And other countries are just going to tell you, that's not your concern.
And I even think about what it formally looks like. You know, it may not be the same around the world as to what even the death penalty looks like. Is it... I'm sure there are places where, you know, the police and the legality behind getting the death penalty is even not that formal. You know, people are getting killed and it's not even like they went through fair trial or anything
like that. More
discretionary. Exactly. So I think it really...
Indiscretionally.
And I think it needs to get deeper than just the death penalty. I commend that they're talking about it at the anniversary. It's been a while since they ended it in France. But I think it needs to be a deeper conversation than just the death penalty. Like, what else is happening? Are people having, are people even being given their human rights, let alone, you know, being put to death penalty? So, yeah, it's kind of a big, big topic.
Paul, in that discussion, do you think... I mean, we can all say, well, it's not the way. Capital punishment isn't the way. But we also understand there's parts of the world where the ways people are put to death are severely in question.
Well, it's just overall, I mean, someone pointed out, I went to the, checked out a website called the Death Penalty Information Center. Such a thing exists.
Wow.
And they pointed out that every reason has been advanced for supporting the death penalty, whether or not you believe it or not, whether or not you agree, is that the reasoning is fundamentally flawed, that somehow it lowers the death, homicide rate.
Yeah.
No proof of that.
Nope.
Experts say that. And also, it's fundamentally biased against the people who are poor.
Yeah, for sure.
Who are non-white. Yep. And also against people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. As we saw in a recent case down in the United States where they were saying, hey, you can't put this guy to death because of his disability.
Exactly. Most of them who are intellectual disabilities. But the fact of the matter is, it's just fundamentally flawed. And every argument, and it's, and Rami made a good point, beyond the death penalty, it speaks to a problem within the justice system that there is a terrible imbalance for people, again, for people who are disenfranchised economically, people who are, again, non-whites. There's a real bias in there, systemic bias there. And it's also not accessible. Someone like who's disabled, or someone who has a vision impairment, you would have a tough time navigating both the physical way of it, getting into a courtroom, but also just maneuvering yourself through the system itself. It's very difficult.
Very interesting, because you think about so many situations where you think, well, hold on, based on what you've said as parameters, this person shouldn't be getting the death penalty. And I'm talking more in the parts of the world, the more progressive parts of the world that still have it, and you know, the United States, where, and you know, Paul, I used to say that people, you know, the only thing remotely that you could even closely come and say is a benefit to having it, to me, in my opinion, is saving money, and in theory, you don't, with all of the court costs, for people, and how long people end up staying in jail before said death penalty. You know, it's not like years and years ago where it was quicker and people had absolutely no justice to fight it. You know, it's a scary thing. Okay, guys, thank you. A pharmaceutical company, I'll switch over to this interesting one and kind of have probably a question for you guys that you don't expect, but this pharmaceutical company is hoping to get authorization for a new COVID-19 treatment that could be taken at home.
Merck announcing it submitted an application with the FDA for authorization of the drug molnupiravir. It's an antiviral pill to treat mild to moderate COVID in at-risk adults. Eight pills are taken over 5 days. The U.S. has already bought 1.7 million courses for more than $1 billion if authorized, which could happen by the end of the year. The drug would not be a replacement for a vaccine, but is likely more effective at preventing serious illness, hospitalization, and death. Lionel Moise, ABC News.
Ramya, some of the conversations before the vaccine came in, we would talk about what kind of treatment. If I end up in a hospital, what can they give me? What are they trying? What are we saying? No, we seem to hold on to a lot of that, hoping, you know, in time, if I ended up catching this, getting in the hospital, they would have a way of treating and saving people's lives. That went away. Vaccine took over as, and I'm sure many people feeling, well, what is that the treatment? Where are these other particular treatments and stuff? Do you feel that if you were still hearing through the time of the vaccine rollout, some of the hesitancy, would it still be as much? Would it be more? Would people say, well, I'll wait because they're working on these things? Even if we knew, yeah, what we were working on is still a ways away. This particular treatment, if once runs through all the testing and they see if it's going to be what they believe it to be, we're looking for approval remotely, earliest late December. For yourself, do you feel that if you were still hearing about treatments, is it kind of more teasing? Is it more of, okay, well, I think I'd stay away from the vaccine then, or something that you'd say, look, I want the vaccine, and this sounds like it's going to need to be taken with full vaccine coverage anyway if you happen to contract?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people, though they did put this caveat in the clip, in the audio that we heard, that this is not a replacement for the vaccine and people need to get vaccinated. Maybe this gives people a bit more ease of mind. And I think that also for people, not just people who are vaccine hesitant, but people who are just finding it still so difficult, you know, thinking the scare of COVID is still very real, regardless of vaccine, regardless of health protocols, regardless of how much precaution people are taking in all kinds of scenarios to get us comfortable and back out and supporting local businesses and, you know, getting out and experience art and theater and sports. Regardless of all that, there are people who are genuinely, like, you can't do it. You can't seem to get out and live life. Now, maybe for those people, this is a better or something more to kind of make you feel okay.
Right.
But at the same time, Kels, it almost feels like we're putting the cart before the horse. Mm-hmm, like, it still feels like, are you sure we want to be talking about this treatment as if it's already out there? Like they said, once it's approved, they will spend $1 billion, right? The U.S. will put in $1 billion into this treatment. And to me, it seems still too early. Now, that's my hesitancy. Yeah.
Well, and again, it's that skeptical part of us knowing the U.S. has bought so much of this and into it and has it on reserve to buy. Paul, your feelings, are we really, when it comes to this, does society need to hear this kind of thing, though? Or is it that tease?
Well, I think it's two things. It's good to be transparent, especially for a pharmaceutical company,
right,
to be transparent about what they're doing, especially when they're in these very polarizing times. At the same time, they shouldn't wetting people's appetites by giving them, as you said, a tease about what's coming up. You know, only 5 to 6 billion people around the world have been vaccinated so far from the coronavirus, and most of them are in Western nations. We still got people who are in poorer countries, poorer parts of the world who have not been helped, who are still in need of getting a vaccine shot. This is, as Ramya pointed out, you still need to have the vaccine before, even with this, what they're proposing right now in France. I suspect that, you know, let's take care of everybody first to get their first vaccine, the vaccinations. Then we can talk about making it easier, more convenient at home, perhaps.
Yeah.
I think the real problem is making sure everyone's covered, because if we don't do that, we're going to be in this pandemic for a lot longer.
Yep.
Because you know, especially now when the cities across North America are reopening and lifting restrictions.
Yeah. Make sure everyone who wants to have their coverage via the vaccine is covered around the world. Absolutely. Paul, I want to talk to you about some book things now, something that I think is a little up your alley here. A memoir by former MP Jody Wilson-Raybould, detailing her tumultuous tenure as Liberal Justice Minister, is among four titles that are shortlisted for a new Canadian Nonfiction Book Award. Mm.
The Writers' Trust of Canada has announced the inaugural finalists for the $60,000 Balsillie Prize for Public Policy, backed by former BlackBerry CEO Jim Balsillie. Wilson-Raybould is nominated for Indian in the Cabinet, Speaking Truth to Power, which touches on her experience as an Indigenous leader at the Trudeau Cabinet table and how she moved forward following the SNC-Lavalin affair. Also in the running is Victoria journalist Gregor Craigie's On Borrowed Time, North America's Next Big Quake. Karen Rebo, The Canadian Press, Toronto.
If this is a read for you, Paul, or have, or what have, give a thumbs up, a thumbs down, and would you recommend it?
I've not read it yet. I do have it on reserve. But yeah, I would recommend it. Absolutely.
What intrigued you?
First of all, she's the first Indigenous politician to be given the job of Minister of Justice. Yes. That's pretty impressive. And she makes a good case, and I think, and most political observers will probably agree, how basically this, especially the SNC-Lavalin scandal, was really of the Liberals' own making. I mean, the wounds that Mr. Trudeau has had to recover from, the baggage he carries, has been self-inflicted. He does it to himself. If he just like stayed out of it, there'd be no scandal. Mm-hmm. And that's points out very clearly. And she also points out in the book that, and has been pointed out by other Indigenous politicians at the federal level in the past year or so, that there are still some enormous barriers, cultural and political barriers, that need to be overcome to advance the cause of reconciliation in this country. And if you can't even do it with the politicians at the federal level, then it's really hard then to demand it of other people in smaller communities and cities across the country.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I highly recommend the book. It's worth a read.
Awesome. Thank you, sir. Get it on reserve, folks. Ramya, I want to pose this next thing to you. A mom from New Jersey is lucky to be alive, as is her toddler son. He fell in an open manhole while playing recently.
911, where's your emergency?
When her 2-year-old son Henry suddenly fell into an open sewer in Union, New Jersey, Jennifer Morrow says there was nothing else she could have done.
There was no other choice. There was no waiting. I think any mother wouldn't have waited.
The manhole cover likely came loose during flooding from Hurricane Ida.
I just know that he was there and then he was gone.
After calling 911, she not only jumped in to save Henry, she crawled back out and turned on her phone's flashlight so she could see him, then crawled back in. Rescue teams arrived.
The child is out. He's conscious and alert.
Henry and his mom are both fine. Sherry Preston, ABC News.
Absolutely excellent news there. Rum, does open manhole covers ever get on your list of a thought once in a while, ever has, when traveling and navigating cities?
Sure, yeah. And the thing is, because I may not be able to spot them visually, the way that it creeps up, like the thought of uh-oh, is when my cane touches it. You know, you're following along, you're in unfamiliar areas, and my cane touches like a sewer cover or some kind of construction thing, because I've fallen into holes, or not in like really hurt myself, but fallen into construction zone areas where they've dug up things, you know? So it is scary because we may not be able to see them. Now, I understand that this is not like just a sight loss or a low vision exclusive thing, but that's a fear of mine, like especially because my vision is so different from day to night, that when I'm traveling at nighttime, though I'm a decently confident traveler, I still feel like, okay, but there could be a hole anywhere.
Mm-hmm. I've almost dropped my cane down, but not open. And I don't really think a lot about it. I did years ago when I was younger. I used to worry about it in my head somehow. Mm-hmm. Somebody just came along and I'll just take this lid off. And I didn't understand. Well, I don't want to fall in one of those. It was an actual fear of mine. But I think about other things. And when I heard this, I'm like, geez, I wonder how many of us with low vision or no vision, does this actually become something we are concerned about, whether we're starting to travel or it sticks with us? Paul, do you have any, thing that concerns you if you're out walking that you remind yourself, pay attention to, whether it's a windy day and rattly signs or what?
Yeah, when it's in winter, when it's especially those mild days when the sidewalks become all filled with slush. especially the sidewalks that have sort of sunk a little bit. So now all you got is a big pool of water.
Right. Right. I worry about the ice falling.
I walk on that. Yeah, I've had a few times. I've actually fallen a few times, like up to past my feet. Yeah.
You'll hit ice underneath some of them, right? You step in the puddle, you don't realize, or you go through it because it looks like, oh, I'll walk easily on this, and you crack, and you're going into that water you're talking about.
Yeah, that's like, my biggest fear.
Yeah, I feel like if you've had any kind of fall at all, like a stumble or fall, or you missed a step or anything like that, I feel like the fear is in there somewhere. It may not be like the dramatic fear of a manhole or falling through a crack in the ice, but it's there as you're traveling.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Certainly is. Guys, thank you very much. Paul, appreciate you joining us on the roundtable today.
Been a pleasure.
Paul Daniels is going to stick around. He'll tell us what's coming up on Now with Dave Brown in just a few moments here on Kelly and Company. We do the roundtable every week on Thursdays in our second last segment for our roundtable conversation. Coming up next, we wrap up the show. We'll see what's coming up on our show. And as mentioned, Paul will preview Now with Dave Brown.
You've been listening to Kelly and Company. If you're hooked, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform. And be sure to leave us a rating and review. Or you can listen live from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.